Okay, today's talk is Wednesday already. It's in the middle of the retreat, aren't we lucky? All of the initial hard work of settling in is gone. We have lots and lots of time to enjoy the peace and the tranquility of this retreat. The talk I'm going to be giving this morning concerns one of the questions which came up last night. It just reminded me that some people manage actually to get into very deep states of meditation almost without expectation, not realizing that they're very close. There's a question which really stayed in my mind from last night. Was the one which was written by the person who said that they were sitting here during a talk and decided to try and recreate what they said Ajahn Brahm does, and actually to go into one of the jhana states, and they came just so close. So every retreat I give, I like just to explain what the jhanas are, how they appear, and how they develop in one's meditation. Because sometimes you do tend to press the right buttons. It just happens that you manage to develop deep states of meditation, and very often you get so close, and sometimes just some fear or some excitement stops you going deeper. And realizing that and understanding that and knowing what a great shame it is that one gets so close and almost at the door to something wonderful and beautiful that one turns around and doesn't go in. Because of that, I like to talk about the jhanas, because it encourages people. It almost conditions your mind. So if that actually does happen to you one day, you'll remember these teachings. They'll go deep inside of you to be used at that time when you do get very still, when nimittas do come up, and then you will know intuitively what to do because you heard these talks, and then you will be able to allow yourself to enter those jhana states and get all of the beautiful insights and blisses which result from that. So I'm encouraging the attainment of those jhanas just by talking about them. And for those of you who think that, oh, I'm just such a long way away from jhanas, it will never happen to someone like me, never think like that, because sometimes just you press the right buttons and there you are. It's not as if you have to build up these parameters, you have to keep on building up slowly, slowly. But sometimes it's as if you just manage to pop your head above the wall, even though you spend most of your life with your head below the wall. You just manage to do it one day. And then it's great to know what to do to keep your head up there so you can see over the wall into the world beyond. So here I'm going to be talking about what happens when you develop the jhanas. It also, it makes a progression from what I've been talking about so far. Just the way of letting go, and just how the more you relax, let go, the more that things do become still, and that stillness does start to build up. It starts to build up into peace, into happiness, and the mind starts to become bright. And when the mind starts to become bright, these things happen. To give a simile of what happens when you're meditating and why nimittas come up first of all and then jhanas, I use the framework of the six senses. The five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and the sixth sense of mind. The Buddha always talked about those six senses from the very beginning. And in meditation, sometimes you may think you know what this mind is, but the truth of the matter is that the mind is so swamped by the five external senses that you really don't know the mind at all, not the pure mind. Only know the mind when it's mixed up with seeing, mixed up with hearing, smelling, tasting, or mixed up with touching. So much so that the real mind is completely out of one's experience. One doesn't know what it is. I often use a simile in chemistry to know the properties of a substance like gold or like iron or whatever. You have to purify that substance to get pure iron or pure gold. Once you've got the pure gold, then you can test it and know what its properties are. In the same way, to know what the mind is, you have to get pure mind. A mind which is free from all the five senses. So there's no seeing, no hearing, smelling, tasting, touching going on, just pure mind. And then you can understand what this mind is. When you have experienced that pure mind, then the five senses have completely disappeared. And all the echoes, which I call the thoughts of those five senses, all the echoes of the five sense worlds have disappeared, and you've got pure mind. And you get to know what this mind is. And what it is this entity in and of itself, which is so swamped by the five senses. I usually use my two hands, so this will never come out on the tape. My left hand is held high, my right hand is held quite low. The left hand symbolizes the intensity, the amplitude, the strength of the five senses. And the right hand, which is way down here, close to the ground, represents the strength, the intensity of the mind. Because the mind is so weak, and because we put too much attention on the five senses and the world outside, the mind gets swamped. It hardly gets any energy, any real attention. It's the senses get all of the energy, all the attention. But when we meditate, you've understood by now that we are tranquilizing our five senses. We're settling them down. We're letting go, in particular, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches. You close your eyes, so you don't see anything. And you don't disturb the noises, as I said last night. So after a while, all the sounds just disappear, all the feelings in the body disappear. And we talked about that quite a lot. When the body tends to disappear, you can't feel your hands, your legs, your face, everything is gone. The feelings in the body disappear. And those five senses get weakened, then we tend to think about those five senses. We see the world in their framework. So we still haven't truly let go of those five senses yet. But you're weakening the five senses. You're weakening your attachment to the body, to sights, to sounds. And when those are weakened and the five senses start to lose their energies, you're not putting attention on it, just like in a garden, just not watering them, so they're not growing. Then there comes a time when the mind receives that energy, gets stronger and stronger, brighter and brighter. And what happens is there comes a time when the mind is about as strong as the five senses. They're on an even par. When that happens, you find nimittas pop up into the mind. All that those nimittas are is the five senses are becoming quiet, the mind is becoming strong, the mind is becoming a little bit stronger than the five senses. You see a light appear in the mind. Usually at first it only lasts a few moments before it disappears and the five senses dominate again. When you see the beautiful light in the mind, it shows you that the mind is becoming strong. Those of you who sometimes don't see a light, but you feel a sort of brightness all over the place, again, it shows that the mind is becoming stronger. The mind is growing, it's maturing, and beginning to show itself. So the beginning part of the meditation is to do whatever it takes to suppress, to quieten down the five sense activity. We let go of past and future, which takes away a lot. We let go of the thinking, which stops these echoes of the five senses, because we think in terms of the realm of the five senses. We never think in terms of mind, because we don't know that world. They're just echoes, leftovers from our sensory experience. But then, we have to somehow let go of this body. And the only way to let go of the body is by stages. You have to choose one bodily function. One object is almost like our doorway out of the body. It's where we choose the breath. And the breath, we focus on it to the exclusion of all other feelings in the body. It starts as a physical feeling, but as we get very still, eventually that turns off and we get the mental feeling of the breath. It's still an echo of a physical feeling. It is what I call like a leftover, a remnant. It's still not the pure mind yet, but it's a way of leaving the body aside. It's a way of turning off the five senses. And when those five senses are turned off, the breath meditation has done its work. You let the breath completely go, it's finished with. And then you get this beautiful nimitta to arise in the mind. You're just sitting there, if you do the breath meditation, you're watching the breath go in and go out effortlessly. You have to have effortlessness in these stages of meditation. If you're trying, you'll never be able to turn off anything. You're just too involved, you're too engaged. You just let go and the breath stays there. It builds up energy, it builds up happiness, that's a good sign. And breath meditation, it gets so lovely, so easy, we call it the beautiful breath. That's a sign the breath is about to disappear. When the breath does disappear, you're just left with the beauty. And that's the place. Sometimes I call it the beautiful breath, it's a mental breath, but really the breath is starting to disappear mostly. When it fully disappears, it's usual that a light appears in the mind. You're seeing your mind, you're experiencing it. It's pure mental phenomena. Now sometimes people say, oh, do you have to see a light? Can't you have a feeling? In truth, it can be a feeling, but you can just as well perceive this thing as a light as you can a feeling. And I encourage people to develop the perception of this experience as a light, because it makes it far easier to deal with. If it's a feeling, it's very hard to make use of that and take it into a jhana. If it's a light, you've got more to work with, more sort of signposts to see where you're going. And for most people, it is a light. Even if you have a feeling, if you just wait for a while, and if you listen to mics like me, you'll begin to experience that as a light. It's just your perception, just what we add on to reality. Because this is a pure mental feeling, you're not seeing this with your retina, of your eyes. You're not feeling it with your body. The body has disappeared. The eyes are not working anymore. The five senses are completely turned off. If you put some sort of brain scan on you, you find out there's no activity in that part of the brain of those senses at all. It's a pure mental phenomenon. I mean, really pure. So that's why I encourage people to perceive this as like a light, a beautiful image which appears in the mind. Now of course when that first mental object appears, there's many different objects it can be, but the most important things to remember is its intensity or its beauty. There's both words pointed to the same phenomena, and its stability, its simplicity. Sometimes when people see nimittas, it's usually very bright and powerful the first time, takes you by surprise, but it doesn't last very long. It's unstable. And perhaps the most important thing to develop first of all is stability of the nimitta. The stability is really measured or really conditioned just by how much peace you had when you actually entered that state. Because how much you've been letting go, how much you develop the tranquility, the steadiness. Which is why if you get into those states very quickly, sometimes the nimitta is just too wobbly and it doesn't last very long. But if you take it systematically, you just gradually let go of the five senses in the body. With that gradualness, that sort of stable type of meditation, you find that the nimitta will last a long time. It will sustain itself. If you find nimittas arising and they don't last very long, it means you've got to work more on the breath, especially on the beautiful breath. Even to the point of interfering with the process and holding your mind on the beautiful breath and not allowing a nimitta to come up. To do that, you're just practicing on the more coarse object of the beautiful breath to be able to sustain your attention on that first. And when you pass that test, the ability to sustain your attention for long periods of time effortlessly on the beautiful breath, then you've trained yourself to be able, when the nimitta comes up, to sustain attention on that as well. All it really takes is a subtlety of the mind, an ability of an observer to watch without interfering. And I think you recognize already that sometimes whatever we watch, we always tend to interfere with. That's a function of the self, the ego, the me. However, we train ourselves to let go on, say, the beautiful breath, to be able to watch that without interfering at all. We are literally letting go of the self in order just to leave it alone, not interfere, and just allow it to be. And if we can do that much, then maybe we have enough skill in letting go. We have ability in actually practicing non-self, in being non-self, to be able to allow nimitta to come up and just to stay with us. If that happens and nimitta stays with you, for most of you, you have no problem. It's a bright and beautiful nimitta to start with. You have enough energy. But sometimes what happens, the nimitta is dull. It means your energies of the mind aren't all that strong. Sure enough, the nimitta is stronger than the five senses, but even the five senses aren't all that strong. You're just dull. And that dullness is not solved by putting in more effort and trying harder and getting up earlier and doing things. That's not the way you brighten up your mind. You brighten up the mind with still practices, with letting go practices. You brighten up the mind through such things as keeping precepts, in being virtuous, in being kind, in being generous. Those people who you know, who you recognize and other people recognize as pure-hearted people, the ones who don't criticize other people, even if somebody breaks a noble silence, I say, never mind, poor thing, they must have needed to say that. You don't go around criticizing others. You're generous in spirit to others. You give other people space. You hardly even criticize the mosquito who's biting you. The mosquito needs to eat somewhere. Poor mosquitoes, that's what they're bred for. They can have some of my blood, even though it hurts. You can be that generous, that pure-hearted, always there to help other people, even though it hurts yourself. Always kind. If you see someone needs something, you just naturally you give it to them. You don't really think you're doing anything good, it's just your nature. You're pure-hearted. When a person has developed that purity of their conduct, their speech and their thought, and it's nothing you can manufacture, it's something you just develop. You can't say, right, today I'm going to be good because this afternoon I want to get jhana. It's just a natural thing which you develop over the years with insight, with practice, with inspiration. And that's the way you brighten up this mind. And this is why when I teach retreats like this, and I encourage people to reach to those heights of meditation, get nimittas and jhanas, sometimes it is almost predictable who's going to get those nimittas. Not always, I often get surprised. But some people you know are just really good people. They're always doing service for others, they're always helping out. And then you ask them for a favour and they never sort of complain, say, of course, even though you know it's hurting them. They're just so generous, they never complain, they never create arguments, they never find fault with other people. Those sorts of people, the pure-hearted ones, the ones you just love for friends, because they're so nice to be around. They never criticise you, they never go around moaning about the government or moaning about this. They're just grateful and peaceful and kind and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. All those things we chant in the morning and afternoon, those sorts of people. Now you know that if I know one of those in the retreat, I know that if they're going to get still, the nimitta is going to come up, that's going to be a beautiful one. That's going to be a powerful one. Because what this nimitta is, it's a reflection of your mind. It's like the mind seeing itself in a mirror. In the same way, when you get up in the morning and you brush your teeth or you have a shave, you look at yourself in the mirror, it's your face seeing itself in the mirror. But here it's the mind seeing itself in the mirror. And this is actually where there's no room for dishonesty anymore. You see your mind as it actually is. I mention that because one disciple in Malaysia, many people from Malaysia here will know this man very well. And he got into a nimitta for the first time. And he heard me talk like this, and he came for an interview straight away afterwards because his nimitta was really dirty and grubby. And I said, well, you know what you've been doing. Because he hadn't been keeping his precepts properly, you know, he'd been a bit slack, he'd been a bit lazy, he hadn't been virtuous. And I actually, you see that right in front of yourself, that's your mind. And there's no possibility of deceiving yourself here. It's just a clear image of what you've been doing. Which is, when that insight came to me, and I was looking at nimittas, you understand why the nimitta was brilliant, why it's dull. You understand just the importance of virtue. So in meditation, why virtue is essential to deep states of meditation. Without that brightness and brilliance, the nimitta has got nothing to hold the attention. Eventually just fades away. It's not compelling enough. We're not talking about this goodness. It's not just you forcing yourself out of ego. I'm going to keep the 5 precepts. I'm going to keep the 8 precepts. It has to be this natural goodness, not the forced goodness, not the conceited goodness. Because sometimes people keep the precepts out of conceit. And they're just another thing which they can say that I'm good at. Now I keep the 8 precepts. How many precepts do you keep? That sort of conceit about spiritual materialism is not what we're talking about. I'm talking about the basic purity, the basic goodness of a person. And sometimes, they don't know what the precepts are. Never heard of 8 precepts, but they're still this beautiful, good person. And that's when the nimitta comes out, that's what you see. So those are the two parts of the nimitta. First of all, its stability and its beauty and simplicity. Those of you who get a nimitta and it's a complicated image of fields, of people, things moving, that's not stable, it's not simple enough. It just means you've got a complicated mind. And you've got to simplify things. The nimittas come up too quickly, it's not the real thing. You've got to just calm the mind down more and more and more. The nimitta, the simile of the nimitta, which the Buddha always used, was like the moon coming out from behind the clouds, like a full moon. Just brilliant and simple. Now by that I don't mean it's a disc, like an oval or like a circle. Although that's the most common, that's the most simplest of shapes. Because you don't really concern yourself with the shape of the thing. Here's an important point, you don't look at the edge of a nimitta, because that's where the shape is, that's where its size is measured. I know that from experience, because many years ago when I started doing this sort of stuff, somebody said, oh, you've got to find out whether it's a small one or a big one. If it's a small one, you've got to expand it. If it's a big one, you've got to contract it. You've got to find out whether it's sharp or fuzzy. You've got to start to see if it's a circle or a star or whatever. And I wasted a lot of time on that until you realise that actually what you were watching to discern whether it was what shape it was, or how big it was, you were watching the edge. And the edge was where there's too much diversity, there's too much going on there. The edge was where something was happening. And you wanted to go still. So the insight from experience soon arose that when the nimitta arises, you don't look upon the edge, you don't try and figure out what size it is or what shape it is, you look at the centre. So the centre where all the action is, or rather all the stillness is. Shouldn't have really mentioned that word action, but that's the meaty part of the nimitta. I shouldn't even mention that because we're supposed to be vegetarian. You get to know what I'm actually saying. That's the important part. So eventually you train yourself, again by programming mindfulness. When nimitta comes up, to keep looking at the centre. Forget about the edges. And that's always the most beautiful part. And that had a great function also, because even if the outside wasn't really brilliant, the centre always was. Even if the outside wasn't always stable, the centre always was still. And that also combined with the whole idea of centering in on things. In just the way that I train myself to centre in on time, to centre in on silence, to centre in on the breath, to centre in the middle of the breath. I kept that process up, and so when a nimitta came up, just the mind went immediately to its centre. The brilliant part, the beautiful part. That's how you can maintain attention on it. By the time a nimitta comes up, remember, the 5 senses have completely disappeared. If you can hear something at that time, then you've not really got the full attention on the nimitta. It's just a bit of a yo-yo happening. Sometimes the 5 senses, sometimes the mind, sometimes the 5 senses, sometimes the mind. You've got to sort of let go of the sound. If that happened to me, I'd go straight back to the beautiful breath. I would not worry about the nimitta yet. Because my mind is not still enough. Or rather, the 5 senses haven't been subdued enough yet. I really wait until the 5 senses are completely gone. You just can't hear anything. You can't feel the body. It's completely gone. Problem which people get is because they're attached to their body, because they're attached to their 5 senses, we don't allow those things to disappear, especially sound, because the sound is the last defense of our body. Even when we're asleep, we wake up because of a sound, a burglar, or it might be an animal, like a tiger has come in, or whatever else you're scared of. Our human body has been genetically programmed, been conditioned over many, many births, to respond to sound as our first line of defense. If an assassin is creeping up behind you, you hear them before you see them. And that's why our sound is something with all the five senses, that is the one we're most attached to. That is our defense. To let go of sound means to give away our sense of security, our sense of safety, our sense of being able to control our immediate environment. It's bad enough closing your eyes and turning your lights out if you don't know what's creeping around in the shadows, but at least you can hear. But if you turn off the lights and it's dark, and also you can't hear, that takes a lot of letting go. So we have to let go of our attachment to our senses, our attachment to the body, it's the same thing, in order to allow the mind to arise. You are testing your ability to let go. All this letting go business, that's what it is, it's cutting your attachments. This word we use in Buddhism over and over again, are you attached, you know if you're not attached, if you can let go of things and give it away. Temporarily is good enough. So if the body disappears and the five senses disappear, you know you're not attached, or not so attached to those things. If you can't, then you should do some body contemplation, or some sense contemplation. Try to find out, just why am I attached to this old body? Why am I attached to seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, whatever else it is? It's nothing to do with me. Give it away, it's not you. If you can, then you can let go and nimittas arise. The trouble and the difficulty which arises with me teaching like this, because of your nature, you think, nimittas, I want. Because that's our nature. Whenever you hear anything like this, you get the spiritual materialism comes up. It's just the same as somebody talks about something on the TV, I want. You've been conditioned, every time you hear something which is attractive, you want it, thinking you can possess it. So be careful, this is not about developing more craving. If you crave these nimittas, you will never get them. Please know that those who want, never get. Those who let go, create the causes for nimittas to arise. Your job is just to do that, to create the causes and conditions so these things arise. You just keep on letting go, creating those causes, creating those conditions. Just like planting a garden, you put the seed in, you water it, you protect it, you know it has to grow, it's nature. That's why each one of you, if you keep on creating these conditions, it's only a matter of time. It's never that you can't do this. Each one of you can, each one of you will, it's only a matter of time. As you let go, the time comes and nimitta arises. Now I'm telling you now to condition you, to brainwash you, to program you. When that nimitta comes, no need to get excited, there's no need to get afraid. This is the path the Buddha took. Look in the suttas, this is the path towards enlightenment. This is the Eightfold Path, the Eighth Factor, Samma Samadhi. So arouse your faith, your confidence, that this is the noble path you are embarking on. There's nothing to be afraid of. This is what's supposed to happen. It's not that something's going wrong, but change, everything is going right. You're following in the footsteps of the Aryas. All the great monks and nuns of the past have walked that path and have got nimittas arising, and have used those nimittas to get into jhanas, and have gone beyond into the insights of enlightenment. If you're on the way, well done. When they happen, don't get afraid. This is good stuff. You're not going to get hurt. There's no terrible things happen to you afterwards. Only great things happen to you. It's all positive. It's all good news. You don't need to be afraid at all. Have that confidence. Have that trust. Because that confidence and trust will allow you to overcome that fear long enough to prove for yourself that that confidence was justified. Getting into the nimittas is blissful, it's beautiful, and you're getting in to very strong states of mind. You're getting even that far to know what the pure mind is. Even if you don't get into jhana with that degree of stillness and depth in your meditation, you may even get the insights that this mind is not subject to the death of the body, but will survive it. That much will give you absolute confidence, the insight that rebirth happens. You understand what gets reborn. Even may understand how it gets reborn. This process called the mind, because you've got the mind right in front of you. You see that that mind is existing when the five senses in the body are completely shut off. In the same way, when your mind and the five senses shut off at death, that's what you experience, that beautiful light. The mind going to the light and out of the body experiences when people die is exactly the same. When you die, that light which you see happens when the five senses of the body turn off at death. So, you're experiencing these things. You don't need to be afraid of them. They're wonderful. The other thing you've got to be careful of is to not to be so excited. What is excitement anyway? It's just a form of conceit. Hey, I've done it. There's no I in this. You don't get prizes. You don't get a medal awarded to you at the end of this retreat. You know, you get the jhana medal, and then you get a bar, and if you get the second jhana. There's no prizes here. This is not a way of increasing your conceit and just having one more achievement in your life. This is not about achievements. It's about letting go of the self, letting go of the ego, and the measuring yourself against others. So be wary of excitement. You know, that, wow, this is it, I'm getting somewhere. Because that again is just this horrible obstacle which stops people just enjoying this blissful state. They go, wow, and they spoil it. And it's such a great shame. Sometimes I feel like crying with some death. Oh, what do you do that for? Because you were so close. You don't need the wow. Leave the wow to the very end. Enjoy it, first of all. Then you can say wow as much as you like when you come out. But at the time, enjoy it as much as you possibly can. So by programming that, the two obstacles at that state of meditation all come from the sense of self, the attachment to me, is fear and excitement. Those are the two obstacles there, so please be wary of that. Once you know that there are snakes on the path at that particular time, and you've been told that, and you remember that, when those snakes come up, they will not bite you. You'll step over them. Fear, you'll step over it. Excitement, you'll just jump over it. You find out what's on the opposite side of that fear. What these nimittas, and staying with these nimittas, truly are like. The nimitta stays. It's beautiful light. At that time, all you're aware of is a beautiful light. No aware of sounds. There's no possibility of thinking or taking notes. You know, we are great note takers, even during the talks. Sometimes people take notes. That's okay. You can take notes now, but when you get into these deep states, please don't take notes in your mind. Don't think, oh, I've got to remember this to tell my friends or to tell that to my mom. Oh, I've got to sort of figure out what this is. Just be absolutely still and quiet, because once that thinking mind starts again, you've lost it. This is why we got this little book, Still Forest Pool. I've got a few copies over here, but it hasn't got the full teaching of Ajahn Chah. That was done by Paul Bright, which is some of Ajahn Chah's stories. But the way I always remember this, Simply the Still Forest Pool, I mentioned it in brief, I think a night or two ago, is that when Ajahn Chah would go wandering, in the evening would try and find a lake or a pond, because he needed to wash his body. It's very dirty just walking all day in the hot jungles. Needed to get some water for drinking, and maybe even to wash a few of your robes. That's why he'd always try and find a place of water in the late afternoon when you're wandering. After bathing, washing, getting some water, he would put his mosquito net umbrella, what the monks of our tradition would sleep in, maybe 50 meters or so away from the edge of the pond. You never put it on the edge of the pond because that's where the animals go. They also want to bathe and drink. And so he put his mosquito net a distance from the edge of the still forest pond. And sometimes he would tell us that he would just watch. He wouldn't meditate, he'd just keep his eyes open to enjoy the animals playing in the evening. It's only when he was still that the animals would come out to play and drink. Because the animals, even though they're fierce animals, all the animals in the jungle are more afraid of human beings, the most dangerous animal of all, than you are afraid of them. So even tigers would wait. If they thought there was a person there, they wouldn't come out. They'd rather be thirsty than risk their lives if they knew a human being was watching. So Ajahn Chah had to be very still. And being a meditator, he knew how to be still. And only when he was still would those animals come out and drink and play. They wouldn't think he was there. He was just like one of these nature photographers who can catch the animals in a natural way. The animals don't realize they're being photographed. In the same way, the animals never realize that Ajahn Chah was watching. And he enjoyed the antics and the games of those animals, as anyone would if you'd seen them in the wild. Now, after the ordinary animals came out to play, sometimes very rarely, and only if he was absolutely still, would very rare animals come out to play. These animals, he said, were so rare that his parents and teachers had never told him that such animals existed. They were wonderful and so very beautiful and extremely rare. Because even if they knew that somebody was watching, they would never come. You have to be very, very still. And then they would play. And they would enjoy them playing by the still forest pool. But when they finished playing, they would go back into the forest. He said that was a wonderful metaphor for deep meditation. In that particular metaphor, the ordinary animals, tigers, to say the breath and the beautiful breath, you've got to be pretty still to be able to watch those play. But eventually, if you're really still, the beautiful animals come out, the ones which are very, very rare, the nimittas. These are so beautiful and so rare that many people don't even know they exist. And they only come out when you're very, very still. But if they come out and you go, wow, even a small wow, they would hear and they'd run away and they don't come out again for months. But if you get slightly excited, ooh, they know and they run away again. For those beautiful animals to come out, the nimittas to come out by the still forest pool of your mind, you have to be that still, motionless. As they come up, you don't move, you don't react. As before they arose, as after, you are just watching, not doing anything. That's the degree of stillness which you need in that state of meditation. Then the nimittas come out. They stay. They play. And you enjoy every moment of them. Sheer bliss. That's what the nimitta is. Brilliant, simple, beautiful, stable. And once that happens, that is the doorway into the jhanas. And so nimitta stays for a while. Then it's the usual experience that that which is watching, mindfulness, the knower, tends to merge, fall into the nimitta, or the nimitta comes and envelops you, and you go into a state of even more bliss. At that particular time, when one enters these states, it's hard to comprehend exactly what you're experiencing. It's only when you emerge afterwards that you have the ability to comprehend, to be able to see exactly what that was. And sometimes, that even when you first come out, you're not quite sure exactly what it was. The reason is because those states of jhanas are so still, there's no movement, that the movement necessary for comprehension is absent. For actually to comprehend, and I sometimes give this simile, we take an object, we look at it this way and that way, we see different angles of it. And when we see it from different angles, we put together the data to get a description of what something is. When something doesn't move, when it's so still, it's almost invisible. In other words, we cannot really see enough details to fully understand what it is. That's what it's like within the jhana. You are perfectly mindful, alert, but mindfulness doesn't move. You're seeing, but you're not moving. And because of that, it's hard to understand exactly what you're experiencing at that time. But what one does when one emerges afterwards and the movement of the mind comes back again, then you can see that object through memory. So the mindfulness which can take a powerful experience recently enjoyed, and then you can start analysing it. And then you find out if it was a jhana or what jhana it was. So you don't analyse in the jhana. In fact, if you do have the ability to ask, what jhana is this? That's a sure 100% certain sign that's not a jhana. Even if you can think, if you say to yourself, this is first jhana, then you can be sure it's not. In the jhanas you can't talk. Yeah, you can't move. So that's the jhanas. There are different jhanas, I've got different tastes for them. I've written a book about jhanas, you can actually look in there if you want to find out the different types of jhanas, but they're all states of stillness. In particular, one of the great things which is missing from the jhanas, not just the body and the five senses, but one of the great things which is missing from the jhanas, especially the second jhana, is called will. And that's a tremendous thing to be able to let go of. The chooser, the doer, the one who's in control. That's what we've been letting go of, bit by bit, throughout the whole of the early stages of meditation. When I say let go, what does that mean? Let go of what? Let go of the controller, the one in charge, that which moves your body, that which moves your mind, that which creates disturbance, the will. And of course, for many people, that is the most scariest thing of all. To give up control of your body and mind is just giving up most of what you take yourself to be. You feel guilty for some things. Why? Because you think that you were in control and you stuffed up. That's why you feel guilty. You feel proud because you achieved something because you think you're in control and you did it right. You always think that you or this will is responsible. And that's why when you misunderstand the role of will, that's why you try so hard to achieve. You think achievement in meditation comes from having a strong and capable and skillful will. And too many people, that's what you do in meditation. You just refine your will. You do the meditation. That's why it never works. It is the will above all things which needs to be abandoned. Letting it go. Doing nothing. Giving up control. Not being in charge. If you can do that straight away, you go boom, 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 right into jhanas. You really let go, like my disciple who went to hospital. I really let go for the first time, he said. What did you let go of? I let go of trying to let go. You let go of trying. You just completely abandoned this will. Now that will is an essential part of your identity. It's so essential that it's scary to let it go. That's why fear is such a big obstacle to get the deeper stages of meditation. The only reason why you can overcome that fear is it's just too nice, it's just too blissful. It's as if you're standing in front of this, it's only one step into those lines. But it's so scary, you have to let go of something which is so fundamental to your identity, to who you think you are. But it's so blissful, you're so scared, but it's so blissful, you're so scared, what the hell will go through? Sometimes that's what happens, the bliss overcomes the fear. You let go. You get into the dharmas. You say, why? What's the point of that, blissing out? It's the way you get into the dharmas is the point. You realize that to get into those states, you've actually seen and overcome many attachments. All those things which the Buddha says is cause for suffering, you've let go of. Okay, only temporarily, but at least you flex the muscles of letting go. You've overcome attachments, if only temporarily. You've overcome attachment to your body. Are you a man? Are you a woman? Are you Singaporean, South African, Australian? Who are you? You're none of these things. Instead, you can let it go. It's not important. Your senses, the touch, the happiness, the pain, just the nice taste of the food, the rotten taste of the food, the stomach ache, or the nice feeling after breakfast, all that stuff, what are you worrying about that stuff for? That's nothing to do with you. Just body, that's all. No more is the wind outside and the rain anything to do with you. You can't control that wind, you can't control the rain, you can't control the weather. You think you can control your feelings in the body, your taste, your thoughts? Yeah, leave them alone. And then they're not a problem anymore, they disappear. To get that far into jhanas is testing what you're really attached to and whether you can overcome those attachments, even temporarily. To get into the nimitta stage, you're testing how attached you are to the body and the senses. You get to nimitta stage, at least you can let go of those things temporarily. The next stage after letting them go temporarily is letting them go permanently with insight. See what they are? You see what it's like to let them go? You've tested it out. Now, you know the difference. It's obvious. You completely let them go. When you get into the jhanas, you know what will want you. You know its cause of suffering, how it keeps moving you, how it creates this business in the world. You know what it's like when the will stops. When you have that experience, at least you know you've let go of controlling. You've let go of craving, desire, will, ill will, all types of will. You've let go of those things. You know what it's like to let it go. Sure, it's only temporary. You come out of the jhana and will reincarnates. But you know what it's like. You've done it once. Now you can do it again. This is where the insight, not just thoughts and ideas insight, that's not really insight, the insight born of raw, mind-blowing experience. Stuff which spins you out for days, which rocks you, seeing things you never thought could exist. Seeing over the wall of the garden in which you've been living and thinking that's the whole world for you. Seeing beyond. Experience in the data of that beyond. That's where the deep insights arise. The deep insights, that's the subject of tomorrow's talk. Today is on the jhana. Letting go. Okay, so I've enjoyed that because I like going for a poke. Any questions? Yeah?
John, you talked about the presence of will, or the absence of will in this stage. If you're in meditation and you try, difficulties in coming out, take half an hour to get out, or something like that,
yeah, it's saying that sometimes in meditation that you have difficulties coming out, the things kicking along by itself, as you said, that's a great sign that will has been weakened. So, you know, there's not much the will is doing, it's sort of sleeping. But in the deep meditation, in the first, especially the second jhana, it's not just, this was just like looking back on those stages, another way of actually really seeing what's going on there. It's not just will as these, it's the potential to will that's gone. Because sometimes will is just subdued. We can will if we want to, but we decide not to. But in the jhanas, even the potential is gone. You're absolutely stuck. There's no way you can move. Sometimes in meditation, you just don't want to move. Here, in the jhanas, it's impossible. So that's like a more profound abandoning of the will. But what you're experiencing there is great, and it's beautiful to have those states. You're sitting here, you're just having a wonderful time, you can't come out. Yeah, I don't want to come out, this is fun. And just letting go of that much is encouraging you to let go of it even further. Allow yourself to go into these deep states where there's no will left. Will is what causes movement in the mind. When you will, you've already moved. When there's no will, there's absolute stillness. That's the absolute stillness called real samadhi. That's why it's weird. That's why you can't move, you can't see very much. You're perfect, aware, deeply ecstatic, but it's very hard actually. Wait, not hard, you can't move the mind to actually to see. Like even now, you know, when I look at you, I move this way and that way, to actually to get different perspectives, to find out where you are and how far away you are. The senses have to move to know, because it's all about comparisons. When there's no comparison possible, because only one image there in the mind for long periods of time, it's hard to actually really know. Only later on can you know. So those are signs, what those states are. Yes.
Yeah, I think it was called the taint by the light. And in this man dies, he likes it, you know. And he dies and he meets this light and the rich thing. Not fair, nothing to it, but it's forward. And it was love. And he says he's settling in grace. By this light, this light, I'm just wondering if this is the Lama and then he's dangerous. And then, when he was doing the embrace, he couldn't move. And then it's just like a television came up in front of him. He saw his entire life, he was done with it and bad. And he experienced all the feelings the other person, the receiving person, would have gone through. Like he had been in the Vietnam War, and he actually felt what his victims were going through and things like that. And then from there, apparently some other knights came and he was taken into this hall and they were all dentures. He felt the presence of other beings, but he couldn't see anything. And then there were just the fun beings, or some stairs or something, there were like 12 boxes. And he was taught to choose from those boxes of knowledge and being a teacher of knowledge. And I can't remember everything, but eventually, he had to come back to life, so he ends up in the morgue where he was taken to, and he had to come back because he had to open up a center and do like good things. Is it jhana you go through, or what would that have been?
It's not quite jhana, but it's very similar. It's when they're being embraced by that light and that stillness, that is almost a jhana. But obviously it came out pretty quickly afterwards. If it was the real jhana of death, he stayed in there for many eons, not just for a few moments. It's one or the other invariable qualities of a jhana, is when you're in there for a long time. There is such a thing which I call ping pong jhanas, which is very often the first time it happens, you just get so close. You've got the nimitta, it's very, very still, and you suddenly go in, and you just come out again straight away. Because you get, again, a bit excited. It's a bit too much for you. So So it's a ping pong. You bounce on it and immediately you come out again. And that's very likely that that was similar to the ping pong jhana, being in breaks for a short while but not being able to hold it. But the point is that after those experiences, your mind is very highly energized and very still. Even when you come out afterwards, it still can move. It's got power. It's sometimes what the Buddha called it, it's soft, it's malleable, it's workable. With that type of mind, that's when you can really develop psychic abilities. Because your mind is powerful, but you can actually do things with it. Usually, your mind, you can't do much things with it. You tell it to do something, because it does something else. It's quite rebellious, because it's just too hard. Here you soften the mind up like, you know, clay which is neither too wet nor too dry. You make whatever you want out of it. That's where the psychic power is. Just a small intention. I want to remember my past lives. I want to do this. Small intentions like that, the mind does it. So it's got the ability, it's got the power to do it. So that particular time, just the idea, probably conditioned from what he's heard in the past, maybe it's Christian conditioning or other conditioning, but you could go and judge yourself, find out what's going on, and do something else in life. See all your past coming up. That was the result of your past conditioning. But the actual experience of the light, it is the nimitta coming up. But was not able actually to take that nimitta into the jhanas. Very similar. That makes sense? Yeah.
So, at death, it's when the body falls away, or the sensation bypasses, you essentially get a nimitta, and then you're entering death, which is a jhana?
So not quite a jhana yet, because you've still got the remnants of the five senses, the echoes. That's why people have these mind-made bodies, and they can see, they can hear. The five senses are still happening, but it's not the mind doing it, it's the echoes of the ordinary five-sense world. But when the light appears, that's the opportunity to get into a jhana. That's where you see your mind. The five senses at that time are not working at all. Not even their echoes. So the nimitta which you see in deep meditation is exactly the same as that light you see at the end, when you're dead. However, how you deal with that, what you do with that, really depends on how you've trained in this life. Exactly how much you can let go, how much you can be at peace with things, especially how much you can give up your will. If you don't give up your will, you won't be able to just emerge into that light. You keep doing things. You start planning your future, your next life. We're looking at your past, where I've been, what I've done. You've lost the peace. That's why the death, according to Buddhism, is a wonderful place to become enlightened, if you've had the training. If you don't get it this lifetime, you might get it this death time. Yes?
Okay.
You go first, yeah. She won by a short head. Go on. Saying an interesting thing about what happens if, like, some of your senses aren't so sensitive as others, and then so is it easier to shut them down and get into a jhana, or somebody's handicapped, they may be blind, so that means they've got one less sense to shut down. And it's usually, you know, that when somebody has lost one sense, they compensate for that with another sense, so their hearing becomes really acute. So even though they don't have to worry about visual imagery, they've got to really worry about sort of audio imagery. And they find, oh, it's easier to shut down one sense, the other senses are just so hard to shut down. So you don't gain, you don't lose. That's interesting. I'm not quite sure if this is true according to the medicine. But if a person did lose their sight and they lost their hearing and they lost their sense of touch, smell and taste, even though that, you know, their body was otherwise healthy, I'm sure they would die. The five senses, when they're not active, will shut down the whole body. Because the five senses are not there for the body. The body is there for the five senses. Sometimes people say the five senses are here to protect the body. But no, no. The body is here as a vehicle for the five senses to play and find happiness in the world. So when the five senses are gone, there's no reason for a body anymore. Yes.
You talked about the six senses. Are there other senses that other entities or other realms use?
I don't know about that one. Maybe when the Martians come, we can ask them, how many senses have you got? No, it's just that we just talk about the six senses. But actually, yeah, there's the one sense beings, just mind, pure mind, no other senses. I suppose it's true, if people are blind, they're just four sense beings. So yeah, you can have some other sense beings, but usually talk about six senses. And as you may know, if you've ever read Plato or Aristotle, that originally European culture had six senses. Aristotle called it the mind of common sense, because it was common to all the other five senses. In other words, what the eye saw, the mind could also see. What the ear heard, the mind could also know it heard. And the mind can imagine sound. You can remember music. The mind hears that, not your ears. So they called it a common sense.
Is that how the term got started? Common sense?
Well, it's interesting. I'm not quite sure, but certainly that may have been where it got started. But I use that as a joke to say that one of the reasons for the problems in Western civilization is somewhere the 2,000 years between the Greek culture and today, that we lost our common sense. We lost our mind. And we've already got five senses, which made us very materialistic. And it's out there is what we're concerned about. There's very little of what's in here. The realm of the mind is sometimes just the vast unknown. The five senses, we're very skilled at that. And why is it that Western culture only talks about the five senses? And recently, apparently, there was a film called The Sixth Sense, and that was all about sort of psychic stuff. I said, what do you mean, the sixth sense? Buddhists have always had six senses. So has the Hindus and many other cultures. The sixth sense was the mind. And you can actually prove that for yourself. Yes?
Is it possible to
in the first jhana, you can say there's a vestige of hearing, but in actual truth it means you just come out of the first jhana. That's why the Buddha called it the thorn. It's the one thing which can penetrate the first jhana, the sound. But when it penetrates, you've come out. Once the sound disappears, then you just go straight back in. It penetrates it. It's like a thorn penetrating the skin. So is that what can take you out? But not always, even in the first jhana. Sometimes the first jhana can be so strong that the sound doesn't penetrate you. And like a good example there is that fellow who went to hospital. He never heard any sirens. You know, when he's in the ambulance being rushed to Charlie Gardner's hospital. You have to be pretty deaf not to hear all those sirens. He was just deeply in his mind, deeply in bliss, didn't hear anything. And, you know, they didn't even feel the electric shocks on your body. It's amazing, that experience, because it's very rare that, you know, someone is actually in these jhanas and something's happening to them. Usually you're sitting there and you're left alone. So, you know, it's very hard to say whether you would have felt those things. But there was an extreme case. He was in a deep jhana and he had electric shocks put on his body to try and get his heart going. You know, I've seen that on documentaries a long time ago. apparently that just, you know, your body arches up and you, you know, lift a couple of centimetres off the table. I suppose it's quite violent, those things. And they do that because they've really got to get your heart going. And imagine, they didn't even feel that at all. If they did that when you were sleeping, you'd soon wake up. So this was a much deeper than actually sleep. So it actually shows just exactly what's possible in these deep states of meditation. He wasn't unconscious. Perfectly mindful all along. But the body was way away. Could not even feel the body. Fascinating. Is that okay? Sometimes it's hard to know. It's interesting, that fellow, this is actually said in one of the suttas, and I think a Chulalongkorn sutta. So what's the difference between a person in deep meditation and a dead person? He said that the only difference is the warmth in the body. The body's still warm. And that's actually one thing this fellow told me. He said that when he asked his doctor afterwards, the reason, the main reason why he didn't send him straight down to the moors was actually that the top half of his body was still warm. The bottom half was like cold as a corpse. And you know, that's what he expected. You know, when he was brain dead and cardiac arrest, that was what happened at the time. And he'd been obviously like that for a while, he'd expect the whole body to be absolutely cold. But it was warm, and he couldn't work that one out. That was an anomaly. That's exactly what it says in the Buddhist text. It's the only difference. So if you get into that state, you're very, very still, it just, someone for you, make sure you're warm. Then you don't have to go to the mall. Get a what, sorry?
Would you get that deep in the first 4 jhanas?
That's really hard to say, because it's usually only the 4th jhana that you actually stop breathing. So you would either be in the 4th jhana or even deeper. So he really went really way deep. It wouldn't have been the 1st jhana, his heart would have still been beating. So again, he'd never done that before, never done it since. Sometimes these things happen. Now there's cause and effect. It's nothing to do with your, you know, what you think your abilities are, or your previous experience. Sometimes you just press the right button, and then off you go. And sometimes he pressed that button so accurately, so well, zoom, 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 it went to a huge, huge jhana. And it was marvellous. He really thanked his wife for actually giving me that wonderful story. If his wife hadn't sort of noticed and sent him to hospital, we wouldn't have this great story of a guy actually being a deep jhana and having all these machines put on him. It's a brilliant story. So thanks for his wife for overreacting.
Yeah.
Well, that's a hard question to answer, because the Buddha said only 7 days. But there's other monks who actually said, no, you can go much longer than that. I think when the Buddha said 7 days, he just meant, you know, approximately 7 days. Not exactly 7 times 24 hours, not a minute less, not a minute more. He just said, no, that's a longish time. So, yeah, maybe you can last a long time in those states. Yeah?
What's the difference between excess concentration and
The access concentration is a term which is used only in the commentaries. It wasn't used by the Buddha, but it's a fair term. It just means that which is just before and just after jhanas. Because we call it access, but it's upachara, it literally means neighbourhood, in the vicinity of. Calling it access concentration misses half the picture, because it's the same just before as just afterwards. Surely when you're in a nimitta, if that nimitta is stable, then you can say that's in the neighbourhood, you're very close. But also the upachara, you can actually say after the jhanas, even though there's not a nimitta there, the 5 minutes are so still. If you really wanted to, you can turn your mind and go straight back in there. That's also the vichara. Usually the commentary says any state where the 5 hindrances have been completely suppressed. And it's those are the places, they say, where the insights which lead to enlightenment happen. The important point of this is that the insights are not just before you get into jhanas, they're after you emerge from jhanas. You go over the threshold, not just when you go into the house, you go over the threshold when you come out as well. And it's the upachara after the jhana. It's a more certain, more long-lasting, and that is a usual place where people get the insights which lead to enlightenment. Not on the way into jhana, but on the way out. That's upachara. Okay, now you're all excited. All the talking is not worth all that much except to inspire you and to program your mind so if something happens, you know what's happening and you know what not to do. Don't get excited, don't get afraid, don't get conceited. Oh, I've done it at last. Because who knows, one day it might happen to you. Soon. So that's the talk on the jhanas. Now, as usual when I give these talks, I did end 10 minutes early, but we spent 24 minutes answering questions. So, we do have the interviews now. So please come into those interviews, try and be on time, get your questions or what you want to ask. The interviews will be in that room over there. And if it does happen that we go a bit late, past 11 o'clock, then I'll do the last couple of people who should have been interviewed this afternoon. So it may be that if it's 11 o'clock and we haven't finished everybody, then I'll just tack those people on after 5 o'clock this afternoon. So everyone has a chance.